These fires are unprecedented. We've never seen anything like it. Scientists are telling us this is the kind of stuff that's going to happen. Nature is not a political game. Nature is the ground on which we stand. It's the air in which we breathe. And the truth of the case is that there's too much carbon being emitted, that heat-trapping gases are building up, the planet is warming, and all hell is breaking loose.
California Governor Jerry Brown sounding the alarm on 60 Minutes last night. A half dozen wildfires have been burning around Southern California for a week now. Most are under control or almost out. But the big one, the Thomas Fire, spread up the coast to Santa Barbara County over the weekend, forcing more residents to evacuate. It is now one of the largest fires in state history. All this fire and wind is raising big questions about weather and climate and really just what is going on. It is December. Bill Patzert is a climate expert with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Hi there.
Hi.
All right. We heard Governor Brown there saying this is climate related. Do you think it is what we're seeing right now with all these fires?
Well, I voted for Jerry Brown four times, and I definitely agree with him. Climate change has played a big role here.
Okay. And we're talking about this thing called the ridiculously resilient ridge. First of all, what is that and how does it play in this current scenario?
Well, this is a high pressure system which parks itself over the entire western United States. A little different than what we saw a few years ago, where the high pressure was over the Pacific. But the impact is the same. It keeps the jet stream far to the north. The west is hot and exceptionally dry, and in our case, windy. And the Midwest and the Northeast are frigid.
And what does climate change have to do with this? How does it exacerbate the ridiculously resilient ridge?
Well, the temperature difference between the Arctic and the mid-latitudes where we live has been decreasing. And so that diminishes the strength of the jet stream, makes it more variable. And so these high-pressure ridges that we are seeing right now, they tend to be more frequent and longer lasting.
And that's what holds off the moisture from coming when it should come in December.
Exactly. You know, we've had almost 10 months with less than an inch of rain, and so this has been record-breaking dry on top of a very long drought, and so the fuel load is exceptionally high, and of course, this persistent ridge here is exceptionally long. Once these winds start, the ignition from power lines, so all conditions are sort of supersized right now. And that's why we're having these apocalyptic fires.
Hmm. Tell how these ignitions start. What do you mean from power lines?
Well, as the strong winds blow, often 50, 60, 70 miles an hour, they tend to bring down the power lines, especially in what I call the wildfire corridors, Santa Clarita River Valley, the Cajon Pass. These areas are very susceptible to high winds. And these are the areas in the search for affordable housing that in the past we did not build, but we are building now. And so you can see that everywhere below the Santa Clarita River Valley, we've had these high winds which have knocked down power lines, which continue to ignite fires.
What is your forecast for the rest of the winter?
Well, at this point for the rain year, we're less than 10% of normal here in Southern California and Central California. So this is certainly a puny start to the rainy season. We could get rains later. There's good news and there's bad news in that. After all these fires, we could see terrible floods and mudslides. You know, we have four seasons here in Southern California. Droughts, followed by fires, followed by floods, and then topped off with mudslides.
When do the locusts come?
Well, I'm not that biblical. You know, because not all of this is climate change, Madeline. Mm-hmm. There's been tremendous growth in California in the last 60 years. The population has quadrupled, while the population of the United States has only doubled. And so we're moving more and more into these wildland, suburban, urban interfaces. So at some level, we're asking for it. because these are areas that historically have always burned due to these high Santa Ana wind conditions.
Bill Patzer, JPL climate expert, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Madeline.
Coming up, how strict voter ID laws could tilt tomorrow's Alabama Senate race in Roy Moore's favor, and sexual harassment allegations against a prominent California judge. Those stories next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It is down to the wire in Alabama.
Hi, this is President Donald Trump, and I need Alabama to go vote for Roy Moore. It is so important. We're already making America great again. I'm going to make America safer and stronger and better than ever before. But we need that seat. We need Roy voting for us.
President Trump on a robocall for Roy Moore in Alabama. Voters will pick between Moore and Democrat Doug Jones tomorrow in a race that is as ugly and interesting or disturbing as any in recent memory. Ask the pollsters. They will tell you the contest is too close to call, and so there is new reason to focus on how Alabama votes, the state's registration rules, ID requirements, and how those rules change turnout, specifically Black voter turnout. Ari Berman is a senior reporter covering voting rights at Mother Jones. He's also the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Hi, Ari.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks for having me back.
Great to have you back. Okay, so the big Supreme Court decision back in 2013 was actually a case brought by Shelby County in Alabama, and it basically gave states more leeway to make changes in their voting systems, right? And since then, Alabama has made a lot of changes. What have they been?
Yes, you're absolutely right. The case came from a county north of Birmingham, Shelby County, and the Supreme Court ruled that those states with the longest histories of discrimination, which included Alabama, no longer needed to approve their voting changes with the federal government. So after that decision took effect, Alabama put in place a strict voter ID law that could disenfranchise up to 120,000 people in Alabama and is now being challenged in court by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund.
And what are some of the specific things that they put into place?
One of the things they put into place was a requirement that you had to basically have an Alabama driver's license or photo ID to be able to vote. And that doesn't sound like a big deal, but according to federal court filings, up to 120,000 people do not have these forms of documentation. Then there was another wrinkle to all of this, because last year, Alabama said that they were going to close 31 DMVs across the state, the kind of place that you need to go to get the ID to vote. And those cuts in DMV offices disproportionately hurt people in majority Black counties. So 8 of the 10 counties in the state with the highest Black voting population had their DMVs closed. There was a big uproar. The U.S. Department of Justice sued. They found that these DMV closures violated the Civil Rights Act of 1964, but that was another wrinkle to this fight over ballot access and voting IDs.
But didn't they also loosen a law that prevented people who had been convicted of low-level felonies from voting?
They have loosened that law, but there's been a lot of confusion about it. So basically, Alabama had a law that prevented people, as you mentioned, with low-level felonies from being able to vote. Then that was reversed, and the legislature said that people could vote if they had these felonies. But the Secretary of State in Alabama, John Merrill, who has said that he's voting for, who had voted, he actually said he voted for Roy Moore early. He said he wasn't going to spend any money advertising this change. So I think a lot of people don't realize that their rights have been restored if they had a low-level felony. There has been a push by civil rights organizers to register some of these voters. And in response, Roy Moore has said that there is going to be rampant voter fraud by felons. So this has also been a contentious issue in the state.
Well, speaking of John Merrill, the Secretary of State, he was interviewed by a documentary filmmaking team about these new laws, and he defended them. He said, you know, it shouldn't be a big deal to go get a driver's license and vote if you really want to vote.
If you're too sorry or lazy to get up off of your rear and to go register to vote or to register electronically and then to go vote, then you don't deserve that privilege. As long as I'm Secretary of State of Alabama, you're going to have to show some initiative to become a registered voter in this state. There will be no impediment to you participating. But if you want to participate in this process, you're going to have to participate.
Right. So there he's making it seem like it's a privilege rather than a right enshrined in the Constitution.
Yeah, and it's really impossible to have a discussion about voting in Alabama without obviously considering the history of Alabama, which is this is a state that had poll taxes and literacy tests and grandfather clauses and a whole array of Jim Crow era devices to make it harder for people to vote. And a lot of that infrastructure of white supremacy was torn down with the passage of the Voting Rights Act. But there are still barriers that remain, whether it's requiring photo IDs to vote that some people don't have, or shutting down the DMVs where they would go to get those IDs, or blocking people if they have certain felony convictions. So there are still impediments that remain. And Merrill tweeted something about a month ago that I found astonishing. He said that he doesn't know of a single instance of the history of Alabama when a qualified voter has been disenfranchised. And as someone who has spent a lot of time studying the history of voting in Alabama, I just found that astonishing considering the history of Alabama. I don't know if he was just forgetting all of what happened during Jim Crow, but it seemed a pretty remarkable statement for a Secretary of State of a place like Alabama to make.
So what are the thoughts going into this election tomorrow about how these new laws are going to impact the vote when it comes to black support for Doug Jones?
I think if the election is really close, and it looks like black turnout is impacted by this, then we might be talking about this the day after the election. Now, if it's a landslide win for Roy Moore or it's a very convincing win for Doug Jones, then maybe these voting laws had no impact. But I think if it's a close election, we're going to sort of scrutinize all of the rules that Alabama had in place that might have shrunk the electorate. Obviously, there's a lot going on in this race outside of the voting laws, mm-hmm. but I think one thing I've learned just from covering this issue is that the rules of the game matter a lot in terms of who does and doesn't participate, not just in Alabama, but nationally as well.
Well, could you see it in Alabama in last year's election? Could you see the effects of these new rules?
Well, you could see a little bit of the effect, but the thing is, it was such an uncontested state. It was such a solidly Republican state that nobody was really paying attention to Alabama in 2016. So I saw the impact in places like Wisconsin, for example, that were very close swing states that had new voting restrictions in effect, where turnout decreased significantly in part because of these new restrictions, but nobody was really paying attention to Alabama. So I think this election, which is hotly contested, is going to provide some interesting evidence, and then there's going to be a whole court challenge taking place next year challenging the state's voter ID law, in which more stuff will probably come out.
Ari, thanks so much.
Thank you, Madeline. I appreciate it.
That's Ari Berman. He's senior reporter covering voting rights at Mother Jones, and he's author of the book Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. The Me Too movement has moved into the third branch of the U.S. government. Alex Kaczynski sits on the U.S. Appeals Court for the Ninth Circuit, which includes California. For many years, he served as Chief Justice of that court. Well, now, six women, all former clerks or more junior staffers, have told the Washington Post that Kaczynski was sexually inappropriate. Two of the women say he asked them to view porn in his chambers, porn that was not related to any case. Jessica Levinson is here to talk about this, the Weinstein effect on the American judiciary. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Legal on Mondays. Hi.
Mayhem Monday. Thanks for having me.
Never a dull moment. Okay. Well, tell us what one of these clerks, Heidi Bond, she wrote a big blog post about her experience working for Kaczynski. What did she say?
So what she said is essentially that the judge had called her in on more than one occasion and said, oh, you're the computer expert clerk, because she had a background in computers. And he said, would you come in and look at this porn and tell me if it's photoshopped or tell me if it's altered in any way? And then asked her questions like, you know, do you feel aroused by this? Well, I don't. And I don't understand why people would. And which is all a long way of saying called her into his chambers to discuss pornography and have her look at pornography and talk about how it affected her, which I think anyone listening can imagine is deeply uncomfortable, particularly when you're talking about Judge Kaczynski, who is terribly well-known, well-respected, well-connected, and obtaining a clerkship on the Ninth Circuit is difficult enough, but obtaining a clerkship with Judge Kaczynski, who sends many of his clerks to the Supreme Court, I mean, it is, you know, it's like lightning striking, or it's having 15 feathers in your hat, basically. So there's a huge disparity in terms of his power and the power of his clerks.
And he is known as a colorful character, Judge Kaczynski, right? Kind of libertarian tendencies. He keeps a trove of this kind of outrageous material for kind of mysterious purposes, not really sure why, but just because he finds it interesting.
So, right. So you mentioned two things. He is known as, I hear him described a lot as an iconoclast, as a libertarian. I think that he has certainly made an impact on the Ninth Circuit. And people, if you know just a handful of Ninth Circuit judges, everybody tends to know Judge Kaczynski, again, in part because he sends many of his clerks to the Supreme Court, in part because he is a colorful figure. But in terms of the images that you're alluding to, back, I believe it was in 2008, it was revealed that he has kind of had a separate server where he would store graphic and inappropriate and sometimes pornographic materials and or videos, which he said were just like attachments that were emailed to him and that he thought were funny. And he was, I believe, reprimanded for that. But of course, he is still a member of the court.
And has he responded to any of these six women and their allegations?
I believe his response was something along the lines, and again, I'm paraphrasing, of, I've been on the bench for 35 years. So many people have come through my chambers. If this is the worst thing that people have said, then I'm not that uncomfortable. And what's really interesting is that a number of people have pointed to the fact that there was a 1992 case dealing with sexual harassment where he wrote the opinion and he said something, and again, I'm paraphrasing, like, so many women know this happens and yet it's the best kept secret for men. And it shows a certain kind of cringeworthy lack of awareness. Mm-hmm. And it shows maybe his state of mind in terms of not understanding what makes women deeply uncomfortable. But a lot of people have now pointed to that statement where it's a 1992 case and he talks about how problematic sexual harassment is. And now these allegations are coming out against him.
Well, you mentioned the whole clerkship feeder thing and how prominent he is. And he feeds some of his clerks to prestigious Supreme Court clerkships. And so he's seen as powerful in that regard as well. Describe this clerkship phenomenon, because in Heidi's blog post, she says that he basically says to them, I'm going to make you my slaves. Like, you've got to be available to me pretty much 24/7. It sounded horrible.
So a clerkship is what we call working for a federal judge after law school. And typically they are, well, anywhere from the year after you graduate to a few years after. Some judges prefer you have some work experience. And this tends to be the cream of the crop law students who they've done very well in their respective law schools. They have great letters of recommendation. They've published a piece of writing and there's something else that's interesting about their resume and they're a good interview. And there's only a couple of hundred or a few more than that, but a few hundred judges, federal judges in the country. And so obtaining one of these clerkships is really difficult. For your listeners, I obtained one back when it was easier to obtain one.
Not with Kaczynski.
Not with Judge Kaczynski, and with a fantastic judge. And so it is a very small community. And so when you work in chambers, you have not only obtained something that is more difficult than getting a job at the biggest firm, I think, or getting a job for the federal prosecutor's office. So it's very competitive, but you're also working really closely with one person who's a federal judge who has a lifetime appointment, and with a co-clerk, and probably with a secretary. And sometimes, some days, those are the only people you see. So judges have an enormous amount of power. And that's a good thing, because we want them to have power over cases, but they also have power over chambers. And I would say that Judge Kaczynski is not emblematic of every federal judge in terms of the experience that his clerks say that he receives. And so without speaking out of school, I would say people knew that working for Judge Kaczynski was going to be a very difficult, very time-consuming, very rigorous year. But look, you have that on your resume for the rest of your life, and you may go on to the Supreme Court. So it's 1 or 2 years of your life. Mm. It's well worth it, literally making your career. Not every clerkship is that arduous by any stretch of the imagination.
And in Heidi Bunt's case, she did clerk for, I think, a couple of Supreme Court justices coming out of this clerkship with Kaczynski.
She did go on to clerk for the Supreme Court again, which is not unusual. It's still, I mean, clerking for Judge Kaczynski is having lightning strike. Clerking for the Supreme Court is having lightning strike, and then again, and then drowning and coming back to life. I mean, the odds are just incredibly difficult. And it is, I mean, to say that it makes your career is an understatement. It is the pinnacle. It is short of only actually, I think, becoming a Supreme Court justice, which, by the way, if you look at the makeup of Supreme Court justices, most of them have clerked, and sometimes for Supreme Court justices.
Wow. Okay, so what happens now with him? Is there an official process where he will be examined by a panel of judges to determine whether or not his behavior was appropriate?
So I think that there will be an internal discussion, investigation, but I think it's also important for people to remember that, again, we're talking about federal judges, which under Article 3 of the Constitution have a lifetime appointment. The only way to remove them is through impeachment proceedings. And I think that that is highly unlikely. And so you've heard me say this before, which is it's incredibly important who the president is, who's deciding who to put on the judiciary. And it's incredibly important who the makeup of the Senate is, because once you put a judge on the court, it's very, very difficult to get them off. We've had openly racist judges. We've had openly anti-Semitic judges. We've had openly discriminatory judges. And I'm not saying that Judge Kaczynski falls within that bucket. I'm saying it's very, very difficult to get a sitting federal judge off of the court.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Patty Schimmel was the drummer for Courtney Love's band Hole, until she got into drugs, lost it all, and ended up living on the streets of L.A.
My days were spent, you know, making money to get more drugs to stay as, you know, completely numb as possible.
Drummer Patty Schimmel next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. That's Courtney Love and the band Hole. The pounding beat in that tune is provided by Patty Schimmel, Hole's drummer at the time. She grew up in the Seattle area. Both her parents were recovering alcoholics, and she started drinking when she was just 12 years old. In her teens and early 20s, Patty Schimmel played in a number of bands. That was when grunge was really taking over the Seattle music scene. And in 1992, on Kurt Cobain's recommendation, Courtney Love hired her to play with Hole. And then Patty moved to L.A. There, her drinking habit grew to include heroin, crack, and almost every single other drug under the sun. Somehow, she has managed to come out on the other side of an insane rock and roll story and even write a memoir about it. It's called Hit So Hard. And Patty Schemmel joins me now in the studio. Hi.
Hi.
Age 12.
Yeah.
What started you on that path?
That was my older sister. You know, had a friend over and they were drinking and we wanted to try it, my brother and I. I knew that my parents were alcoholics, you know, and I wanted to see what it was all about. And from that first, because I'd felt awkward and different. And when I had that first drink, I finally felt like I'd landed in my body for once.
And at the time, did you know that you were a lesbian?
Yes. That was also part of that mix of awkward feelings. And I knew really when I was right away, you know, when I was young, I didn't really know I was a lesbian, but I knew that I wanted to dress the way my brother dressed. I wanted to do the things he did.
And how did you get involved in the sort of the Nirvana music scene?
Yeah. I started playing in bands and then, you know, my band plays with that band. And then so it was like, kind of like our little scene. Mm-hmm. And whenever anybody needed a drummer, I'd get a call and then, you know, start a new band. And so one of those nights of playing out, my band, Doll Squad, was playing a show with Nirvana, an early version of Nirvana. And that's how I met Kurt.
Yeah. And then he introduced you to Courtney Love. And,
yes.
And she was in L.A., I guess, and you went down to meet her at the Jabberjaw?
Yeah, yeah.
I got a call. Jabberjaw Club?
Yeah. I got a call from Eric, who plays guitar in Hole, and he said, you know, let's set up a time where you can come down and we'll get together and jam.
I love her first interview question for you, which is, what kind of drugs do you use?
Yeah, that was right off the bat.
So you get into this band and you're sort of in their world, and their world is filled with drugs. And
yeah.
You, at that point, weren't doing heroin.
Yeah.
They introduced you. Courtney introduced you to heroin?
No. Actually, I'd been, you know, experimenting with drugs for a long time. And I came home from a tour. And my brother, who I'm really close to, had started doing heroin. And so then it was kind of, well, you know, I'll try it. Like recreationally. You know,
yeah.
Like that's a recreational drug.
Like
no.
you didn't think you would become a junkie.
No.
Because how old were you?
I was 25. And it was all about trying all of it, doing it all. And then, you know, going on tour and coming home, getting strung out and then getting clean and then getting back, you know, out on the road. When I'm talking about it in the book, I didn't want to romanticize it. It wasn't pretty. It wasn't New York in the late 70s cool.
Although when you do describe what it feels like, it feels in your description like nothing else.
Yeah.
I mean, it's like the best feeling in the world.
Yeah. And I wanted to stay there, but you can't ever get it back. And it's then you begin the chase to get there and you never do. And then eventually, it stops working altogether, and then you're stuck.
So you were there when she had her baby, Frances Bean.
Yeah.
And they both were strung out when she was a little baby, right? They were both doing drugs.
I wasn't around directly, so I don't know what was happening when Frances was born. But, you know, she came out on tour with us and she'd, you know, come and watch us play. And she was used to kind of the road. Like she'd come out. She knew about getting on the bus. She knew about wearing her own earphones.
How old was she?
She was like two and three. Yeah. So.
And you lived with Kurt and Courtney.
Yeah. I lived with them when in L.A., when we were trying to find a bass player and trying to get our band, you know, put together and start to, you know, finish writing for Live Through This.
And so, and you were also there when Kurt, when there was that famous intervention.
Yeah.
And you were there for Kurt.
Yes. And the idea of an intervention, you know, was so crazy. And I talk about that feeling of, well, who am I to say when I'm doing the same thing, you know, but I'm not the one that is fueling a billion records worth of a label, you know, mm-hmm. what I mean? And so there was a lot of people there, a lot of people in suits, you know, and a lot of people that loved him. And he was alone upstairs and looking out the window at a way to get out. And I know that feeling. I get it. And I think that he felt that, you know, when the drugs stopped working for him, he didn't see any other way out. And it's hard to tell somebody, too, when they're at that place, you know, and it's hard to back them into a corner and tell them just with words that, you know, we love you and we want to help.
And that was the last time you saw him?
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he killed himself, and then Kristen Pfaff died of an overdose, what, 6 weeks later?
Yeah, it was really close after. And
a member of your band.
Yeah.
And you were supposed to see her that night or hang out with her, and you said no because you were trying to...
Yeah. Well, when Kurt killed himself, it was me as an addict at the time. You'd think that it would be time to stop using drugs. And what I did was I went into rehab for the first time and did, you know, 21-day rehab program and came out. And a couple days later, Kristen phoned and said, you know, I'm going to move back to Minneapolis and take a break. And I had some of her things. So I was afraid of going over there.
Because you thought you'd start using it again.
Yeah. So a friend went over there. And I guess later that night, she'd OD'd.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with former Hole drummer Patty Schemmel. Her new memoir is called Hit So Hard. So you go back on tour and you get back into the drugs and it gets worse. And finally, you're kicked out of the band.
Mm-hmm.
And you lose everything.
Yeah. And my part in that was just for the fifth, you know, time in rehab. And the band is like ready to start writing and recording the next record, and I had just gotten out of rehab, and I walk into the rehearsal place, and there's, you know, Billy Corgan sitting there plunking away on the piano with some really amazing melody, and I'm like, shh, Billy, shh, 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 I just got out of rehab, not so loud. It's like not ready to start working on music at all. And our management, they were at the point where they were like, okay, you're going to make the next step to arena rock band. So then, you know, I was replaced and a drummer sat in and played my parts. And that was the end for me because that was all I was in my mind, was the drummer of Hole. So, you know, I left and was fired and, you know, then, you know, spent the next year or two completely out of my mind, and then lost everything and ended up on the street.
You ended up on the streets?
Yeah.
For how long?
For about a year.
So you were like someone we might see.
Yeah.
Driving.
Yeah.
By on the freeway underpass. That would be you.
Yeah. And, you know, my days were spent, you know, making money to get more drugs to stay as, you know, completely numb as possible.
And you became a prostitute?
Yeah. And as a gay woman, that wasn't difficult for me. I mean, it is horrifying, but first of all, being high, I would do anything to maintain my drug habit. And also, I would just sort of leave my body so that way it was easier.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't have a good hustle at all. You know, I was never good at any of the stuff that, you know, I'd see other people doing. They had great scams, and I could never, I wasn't good out there on the street at all. Like somebody don't know.
I mean, that's yeah.
I guess that's good. Yeah.
It is a good thing.
Yeah.
But you had to rely on other people, and this guy who was your pimp.
Right.
Who took all your money.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that's that cliche. It's that totally, it's the ABC after school special.
Right. So did you, I mean, so you said you were disassociated from your body when you were doing these sex acts.
Yeah.
Or whatever. But were there ever moments where you were in that life and you were like, oh my God, I used to play in front of 70,000 people. I used to stay at the Ritz.
Yeah.
What am I doing on the street corner in front of this empty lot turning tricks for heroin?
Yeah. There was a moment where in the neighborhood, one of the streets where I mostly stayed, there was a church and the doors were open and there was an old drum kit in the back. And I saw the drum kit walking by and remembered, I'm a drummer. And for that moment, it was right in front of me and it all started to sink in what I'd lost. And there wasn't enough drugs that day to make it go away. And at that point was when I reached out and Musicians Assistance Program, MAP, helped me get into rehab. They took a chance on me because they'd taken many chances. And I stayed in the rehab program for 30 days, but also went into a sober living because I had to. You know, this time I wasn't in rehab to get everybody off my back the way it used to be, you know, so I could keep my job or, you know, so my mom wouldn't worry or, you know, because I was court ordered to. I really had nowhere to go. And I went into a sober living with other women that, and each of those women were getting jobs and starting their lives over. And so I started over from scratch, from nothing, that I didn't try to get a job as a drummer or get a job at the studio or the practice space or, you know, the drum shop. I got a job at a dog care facility. And slowly in that job, I was able to, you know, like my boss would say, that's good job. You know, little things like that were steam building. And it wasn't about being in my band. It wasn't about how cool I was or anything. It was about the kind of job I did and that I showed up and did a good job.
How is it for you revisiting your past self? Because now you're married, you have a child, you're clean,
it's such a, you know, sometimes I think about how the galaxy away, it was like a different person, but it isn't, you know, I'm still that person. And I get reminded of that person when there was a day when I was taking my daughter to school and there was a shortcut and it took me, you know, my GPS took me through one of the downtown streets I used to hang on, you know, and it brings me right back there. But today I'm driving my daughter to school, you know, and, you know, it's like that actual realization that I'm powerless, you know, like one moment where I'm thinking, a glass of wine, you know, will, you know, take me right back there.
And so when you look back on that part of your life, I mean, it was so dramatic. You could have died. You could have been Kristen. You could have been Kurt.
Yeah.
But you weren't.
Why me?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. And I don't know why I'm here and they aren't. And what what I think about, that was another sort of impetus for the book was to write the story and to share it. And that's why me.
Well, Anna, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. That's Patty Schimmel. Her memoir is called Hit So Hard. That's Hole right there with Miss World.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The Golden Globe nominations are out today, and this really was a great year for TV. The Deuce, Big Little Lies, Master of None, the list goes on. The good news is you can catch up on all you missed over the holidays. This is the perfect time to binge watch things you may have missed. And Alan Sepinwall is back this year to help. He has a top 10 list. He's TV critic for Up Rocks and author of TV, the Book. Welcome back, Alan.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Okay, we are going to go in depth on 1 through 5, the top 5, because of time constraints. So can you breeze through 6 through 10?
Sure. Number 10, I had Netflix's One Day at a Time. At number 9, HBO's The Deuce. At number 8, Netflix's Master of None. At number 7, IFC's Brockmire. And at number 6, the Showtime return of Twin Peaks.
Wow. So all of those are not on network television.
No, I do have one broadcast network show in my top 5, though, which is fairly unusual in this day and age.
It is. All right, so let's get to that in a bit. Let's go to number 5. This is one of my favorites, Better Call Saul. Here's Bob Odenkirk. That is Saul, otherwise known as Jimmy.
I submit that Mr. McGill's mental illness is a non-issue. If he were schizophrenic, it wouldn't take away from the fact that the defendant...
I am not crazy!
Okay. All right. You say this is season three, is the best of them all so far?
It really is. Earlier this year, I actually published a whole book about Breaking Bad, and so I went back and rewatched a lot of that show, and it's shocking how well Better Call Saul holds up to it, because, you know, that's one of the great shows of all time, and the spinoff or prequel or whatever you want to call it is really special, and the performances, especially by Odenkirk and Michael McKean that you heard in that clip, the stuff between the two McGill brothers has almost nothing to do with the world of Walter White, and yet it's so incredibly compelling, even in a year where they brought back Giancarlo Esposito as Gus Fring, where they had a whole bunch of Breaking Bad characters existing a little bit outside of Jimmy's orbit.
Yeah, there are all sorts of Easter eggs in it if you've seen Breaking Bad, for sure.
Yeah. Including Huel, the character who pops up in that clip.
Yeah, I love Huel. Okay, let's move on to number 4. This is a new show from NBC. Here's your broadcast television entrant. It's called The Good Place, starring Kristen Bell. Here's a clip.
You are my soulmate.
Cool, bring it in, man.
You'll stand by my side no matter what, right?
Of course I will.
I wasn't a lawyer. There's been a big mistake. I'm not supposed to be here.
Here being heaven, right?
A version of heaven, which by the time we got to the episodes that aired in 2017, turns out to be a lot more complicated than that. This is a really smart and surprising comedy from Mike Schur, who is the co-creator of Parks and Recreation and Brooklyn Nine-Nine, among other things. And it's one of those shows where it keeps surprising me again and again with how fast the story is moving, with where it's going, with how crazy it can be, even as it's also having characters have very sincere discussions of moral relativism and other philosophical concepts.
Hmm. Yeah, because when I saw the debut, I thought, how long are they going to be able to keep this going, this gag?
No, and then when you get to the first season finale, which aired back in January, it turns out that things are not at all what they appear to be. And even then, I thought, okay, well, how long can they keep the show going after that twist? Mm-hmm. And it turned out by the first couple of episodes back in the fall, they had burned through that story and moved on to another one, and then another one, and then another one. And I don't know how they do it, but they're doing it.
Number 3 on your list, Halt and Catch Fire on AMC, which has been described as basically Mad Men for the computer age in the 1980s. Here's a bit from the trailer for the latest season.
If you want more funding, I will need a bigger idea.
We needed you to care.
Do you want to talk about what we're really talking about?
The computer can't tell me what I want.
Maybe someone out there is trying to hurt me.
This can't be my last thing.
All right, you say this show really picks up in season 4, but that's a lot of episodes to wade through before.
Well, what I would say is the first season is not that great, and that's back when it really was sort of shamelessly Mad Men in the early personal computer age. It evolved pretty quickly. By the time you get into the second season, it's a really good show, and then the fourth is one of the great final seasons ever made. So you got to suffer through a little bit or maybe just skip most of the first season, but what they were able to do in this last year in terms of building on everything we knew about these characters was really extraordinary, and I cried an awful lot watching the finale, not even necessarily at big life events like births or deaths or anything, but just characters talking about friendships and people coming up with ideas. And that's a really hard thing to dramatize, and this show did it beautifully.
Wow. So best last season of all time in all TV?
One of. I don't want to overhype it, but it's really great.
All right. Number two on your list, Better Things. This stars Pamela Adlon. She also directed all 10 episodes of this season, and she's nominated for a Golden Globe for Best Actress in a Comedy. Here's a clip.
See, baby, you got your choice.
Mom? You're the best mom in the world.
Aw, that's very sweet.
It is very sweet at times. It's also make you want to tear your hair out at other times. One of the things that's special about that show is I've rarely seen something that captures both the aggravation and the ecstasy that can come from parenting quite like this does. It's sort of, you know, one minute she wants to kill her three daughters, and the next, you know, they're making her weep with joy, and it gets that really well. And as director, as actress, and as co-writer, Adlon is really doing something special here.
Now, Louis C.K. co-created this show with her. Is that hurting it at all? Are people kind of pulling away from watching that because of it?
Well, the only two episodes of this season aired after those revelations came out, including one that aired that night. And so we'll have to wait and see. He's not going to be involved in the show going forward. And I've encountered some people who say they can't look at this series the same way anymore, and I don't necessarily blame them. I guess the way I'm trying to split hairs here is it's loosely based on her life. She's the one starring in it. She's the one directing every episode, and she's the one who will be with it going forward, and we'll have to see what the show looks like without his involvement. It's unfortunate, but the show itself is pretty special.
All right. Number one, you have chosen The Leftovers. Alan, why is this number one?
Because it's not only as good as I just said that the Halt and Catch Fire final season was, The Leftovers final season was better. The Leftovers overall is one of the great dramas of my lifetime. It's a hard thing to describe to people without sounding like a lunatic. There was an episode of this show that involved a Tasmanian lion sex boat.
There's going to be sex on this boat. There's going to be a lot of it. Debased and sinful from port to port, all without judgment. Is that going to be all right for you?
Absolutely.
And a character speaking to God on the Tasmanian lion sex boat.
What's a Tasmanian lion sex boat?
It's a boat from Tasmania to Melbourne, Australia, involving a sex cult wrapped around a lion who is named Fraser, who has some sort of mystical sexual qualities.
A real lion?
There's an actual lion on the show, and there's a man on this boat claiming to be God.
You do sound insane. It sounds insane.
And I swear to you, I swear to God, whether it's the guy on the boat or not, it all makes perfect sense when you watch it emotionally, logically, narratively. It's just an incredibly powerful show, but also a ridiculously fun show. It's a series about the end of the world and grief and depression and madness and all of these things that do not sound like they could be entertaining at all, and yet I laughed more watching The Leftovers than I did at anything else this year that's actually considered a comedy, in addition to bawling my eyes out on the regular. It's fantastic.
Okay, so given that the Golden Globes came out today, and the nominations, I should say, came out today, and given what you've just told us, did they miss the mark in any big way in your mind?
Well, there's no nominations for The Leftovers, so from my perspective, they missed a lot of the best shows on TV, but there's so much great TV in general, so you kind of look at it and you say, all right, well, they picked some good things, that's good enough.
Okay, but we'll go with your picks.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Alan Sevenwald, TV critic for UpRocks and author of Breaking Bad 101, also TV, the book. Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, Madeline.
And Christian Bordahl is here now with his
Madeline.
Favorite TV.
Yes. Well, I asked our listeners for their recommendations for the best of the year in TV, and we've got a bunch of suggestions on our Facebook and Twitter pages, so people should just check those out if they're looking for
other recs. You know,
yeah, exactly.
Okay.
And then you may remember that a few weeks ago, I polled listeners on who they thought would win the Alabama Senate race, and back then they were pretty heavily expecting the Democrat, Doug Jones, to take it. The vote, of course, is tomorrow, and I polled again today just to see what people were thinking now, and the split, as you might expect, is much more even. 56% now think Doug Jones is going to win, and 44% say Roy Moore.
Which mirrors
what's been happening in the polls. Yes, exactly.
Neck and neck.
Neck and neck. Mm-hmm.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. And I don't think it'll be amiss to spill the beans on your favorite show. It involves cross-country skiing.
That's right.
Christian loves the excitement of cross-country skiing. Okay. Thank you for that. Thanks for listening. I'm Madeline Brown. I will see you tomorrow.